From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up...
I'm honored that, 65% of people that went out and voted thought that I was doing a good job and that I should continue in this job.
Our message connected beyond color lines, political lines, that we've had Trump supporters, Bernie supporters, folks who had never voted before. That diversity means a lot to me.
We'll talk about Massachusetts election results and about allegations of rampant sexual harassment at Berklee College of Music. It's all in our Week in Review. Also today, the Massachusetts Marine General who was the public face of the Persian Gulf War.
Well, from a military point of view, nothing went wrong. The target was struck as designated.
General Richard Neal joins us to talk about lessons learned in his more than 30 years of service. Plus, just how far is the justice system tilted against America's poorest citizens? Georgetown Law Professor Peter Edelman describes how we've criminalized being poor. That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today, we're going to start with retired Marine General Richard Neal. He grew up in Hull, Massachusetts, graduated from Northeastern University, and served multiple tours in Vietnam. His distinguished service took him to commands at nearly every level, battery, battalion, and division, and then to U.S. Central Command, serving under General Norman Schwarzkopf in the early 1990s during the Persian Gulf War. Neal briefed the press daily on coalition progress. He was the military's public face during that war. In 1996, General Neal became Assistant Commandant of the Marine Corps. He retired in 1998. And he tells the story of lessons learned in his 30-plus years of service in his new book, What Now, Lieutenant? Leadership Forged from Events in Vietnam, Desert Storm, and Beyond. And he joins us today from Hull. General Neal, welcome to Radio Boston.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I look forward to speaking with you.
It's a pleasure to have you. I just want to start with a really basic question. The title of your book, What Now, Lieutenant? I mean, you describe these as very specific moments in your life. So what is a What Now, Lieutenant moment?
Well, I'm sure a lot of people think it's a little bit strange for someone that made 4 stars talking about What Now, Lieutenant. But we all begin someplace, and that's where I began as a lieutenant a long time ago. It was a phrase that newly commissioned officers encountered when they underwent the 6 months training program at Quantico, Virginia after graduation from college. However, we entered either going through officers' candidate school or through the platoon leaders class. And once we got our degree, we raised our right hand and took the oath of office. And once we did that, the next step in the Marine Corps pipeline was to send us down to Quantico. And the instructors down there, we were newly commissioned lieutenants, of course. We were probably about as useless as anything, but they took their great patience. They put us into different scenarios where they would create crisis. Now, the crisis might be social. It may be one of your young Marines got into trouble out in the town, mm-hmm. drinking or DUI, or maybe it's a home problem where the wife has been sick and so he's forced to be late. And so those types of events. And then, of course, the worst case, but probably the one that was probably most prevalent in our minds during 1965 for me, was what would you do in combat? And
right.
So they would present you with different events, and then it would be up to you as to what now, Lieutenant? What are you going to do? What's right. your action? And so that's kind of the basis for the title of the book, and then, of course, I went into some detail talking about a particular battle I was involved in.
Well, yeah, I mean, you call this battle the battle for Hill 70 in Vietnam one of, if not the most important moment of your life. So can you tell us the story of what happened?
Yeah, it was an amazing event. I was the forward observer attached to the company, so I wasn't part of the company. I was attached to the company for a duration, usually in 6 to 8 months length. And basically, I would provide fire support from an artillery outfit that I was that I belonged to. And so I would travel with the infantry out on operations, and then if a need arose, I would call in fire support to support the maneuvering forces. On this particular case, we're out on an operation for about 3 days, and we were we split up the company, and although the company commander was not really supportive of this move, and he actually raised his lack of support with his senior officer, the colonel, but he was told to carry out his orders, which he did. And we split up into three groups, and I was sent with the first platoon because there was a good high likelihood that that platoon, if anyone was going to get into trouble, it would be that platoon, and mm-hmm. so I would be able to respond with fire support. We had moved out for perhaps maybe not even 30 minutes when we heard mortars being fired, and they were enemy mortars, and immediately the company commander came up on the net and said to the platoon commander, John Prickett, "Hey, John, turn around." And, well, we actually called him, and he said, "No, just hold up for a minute." And then a few seconds later, he said, "No, we're in trouble. Get back here and tell Butch to provide fire support to these coordinates." And he read them off to me. And, of course, as soon as I saw him, both John and I said, "That's your position." And the company commander came back and said, "Yes, they're in the wire," yeah. so to speak.
So, General, I'm so sorry to interrupt here. Mm-hmm. So forgive me for doing that. I'm just a little – I'm conscientious of the time. And forgive me again for interrupting.
No problem.
I mean, you write about the fight for Hill 70 in detail in the book. And, I mean, one of the main points that you make is many good men that you knew that day gave up their lives. In order to see the battle through to its end, mm-hmm. Medal of Honor winners, in fact.
Yes.
I'm just wondering how it changed you that day.
That's a good question. I think it changed me in several ways. Not changed me, it probably just made a realization, number one, I had to take command of first the platoon, and then I had to take command of the company because the company commander was killed and the platoon commander was seriously wounded. So I had to jump into a role. It was my what now, Lieutenant moment that I talked about a few seconds ago. And what came across so much is we were in the middle of the firefight, and all of a sudden I was treating the platoon commander who was seriously shot, and I looked up and everybody was sort of looking at me. And so they were looking for me for leadership, and obviously I started to maneuver them and got them moving in the right direction, and we carried the day, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But I guess what really impacted me the most was the trust that those young men had in me and in my ability to lead them, and then my understanding that I was able to do that when that moment did show up and I had to do it. I would correct one thing you say. We weren't really fighting for Hill 70. We were going back to Hill 70 to try and rescue those that were being overrun.
I see. My apologies.
It's not apologies. It's an important ingredient.
Well, yeah, I agree. And we try to get it right. So I appreciate your correction here. But in terms of sort of the what now, Lieutenant moment, I mean, if we fast forward a couple of decades, you find yourself at U.S. Central Command for the Persian Gulf War, becoming the public face of military operations for that war by doing the media briefings every day.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say, I did chuckle a little when I read the part of your book where you described that, you know, you were in standing before television cameras and reporters. It was a sometimes hostile audience.
Hostile might be too strong a term. Challenging, I guess I would say.
Well, hostile is your word from the book, sir. but if I may, I just want to ask you, I mean, like, I was actually kind of surprised because here you are, a Marine general, and in the book you described that, like, at the first briefing that you did, you were pretty nervous.
I was. I guess I would go back to the hostile term. You really never knew what the questions were going to be, and a difficult thing for someone that's in a position like I was at that time, I was a one-star, brand-new one-star, and was getting up there in front of all of those cameras, which I was not used to, and then, you know, the what now, Lieutenant moment of they ask me a question I don't know the answer to. And so do I wing it and try to give them something, or do I say, geez, I don't know, but I'll get back to you? I opted for the latter. I don't know the answer to that question. And that's difficult for you. You know, you feel like you're supposed to be the smartest guy in the room, but all of a sudden you're challenged by a question that you don't know the answer to. But legitimately, or I guess for some reason, I had enough forethought and malice to think about saying, I don't know the answer, but the key ingredient was, I'll get back to you with the answer. And, mm-hmm. and we just saw that the other day with General Dumford when he was asked about what transpired in Niger.
Mm-hmm.
Here he is, the most senior of military officers on active duty, and, you know, as the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and he was asked a question, you know, a very solid question, a legitimate question, but he didn't know the answer. And to his credit, he said, geez, I don't know, but let me get back to you on that.
Yeah. So, you know, your book, General, is full of such rich detail and so many amazing stories that I'm really feeling terrible that we're running down on time here. But I'm hoping someday we'll get a chance to talk again, because I'd love to hear more of the stories of your career. But my last question for you, since we are running out of time, is that we, you know, here we are speaking on today, which also happens to be the anniversary of the creation of the Marine Corps.
Mm-hmm.
I just wonder, you know, looking back, what has your service meant to you?
Fulfilling. Job satisfaction, if there's such a thing. Being a Marine, we didn't consider it a job, but, you know, a profession. And it was fulfilling because, you know, I was given the golden opportunity to work with some of the finest young men and women that our country produces. And being with them and being around them each and every day really was the motivation for me to stay in. When I graduated from Northeastern and went in, I had no intention of staying beyond probably the 3 years of my enlistment. But once I got there, and even in that terrific battle that I was involved in as a brand-new lieutenant, even in spite of that, it was just being with these young men and women and having the opportunity to help mentor them, to develop them, and to hopefully protect them. It was something that was so fulfilling that it was an easy decision, and fortunately my wife agreed.
Yeah. Well, General Richard Neal is a retired 4-star Marine Corps general. He's the author of the new memoir, What Now, Lieutenant? Leadership Forged from Events in Vietnam, Desert Storm, and Beyond. Speaking with us today from his hometown of Hull. General Neal, thank you so very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it. All the best.
All the best to you as well. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It is Friday, so let's get into the week in review. Top story this week, local elections.
This was never about me. It was never about Mayor Walsh. It's always been about the people of the city of Boston and their future.
I'm not waiting for an inauguration. We're going to hit the ground running, continue to look at the housing and continue to look at how we can create more housing in our city.
Here is a kid from Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn. And even though I've lived here for 32 years, I'm still not what we call a townie, can come to Framingham and see opportunity.
Well, I think any government body definitely should reflect the folks that are going to be directly impacted by them. So, yes, having half the council be people of color in general, I think is just reflective of Boston.
Well, you just heard from City Councilor-elect Lydia Edwards, Framingham's first mayor-elect Yvonne Spicer, Boston Mayor Marty Walsh, and Boston City Councilor Tito Jackson there. So joining us to talk about what happened at the polls on Tuesday night is Michael Curry. He's former president of the Boston branch of the NAACP, and he sits on the National NAACP Board of Directors. Michael, it's good to have you back.
Good to be here.
Also with us is Michael Jonas, executive editor of Commonwealth Magazine. Other Michael, it's good to have you back as well.
Good to be here.
Sorry, I couldn't help it, gentlemen. All right, well, let's start with the Boston mayoral race there. We heard, again, from Boston Mayor Marty Walsh, who won the vote. He took 65% of the vote to City Councilor Tito Jackson. I mean, Michael Curry, let me just start with you. You were actually with us at WBUR on Tuesday night for special election coverage. You know, what's your overall take? How satisfied were you with how the campaigns went?
Yeah, I thought it was a respectful campaign. I thought as the challenger, Tito needed to raise some critical issues, and he attempted to do that. I think you got to take jabs at the incumbent around what he or she has not done. And in this case, I thought he tried to do that. I thought the challenge he always had was the uphill battle of trying to reach the electorate with his message. Mm. And this is a tough city, right? The easier campaign is the incumbent because you have all those opportunities to share your vision and to share what you've accomplished. And the challenger has an uphill battle. So I thought Tito fought that as best he could. And he turned out communities that may not have shown up, but for his being a candidate. Mm.
Michael Jonas, let me ask you about that, because I definitely take the point about the power of the incumbency in a Boston mayor's race. It's kind of it's like the story of Boston elections here. But at the same time, I mean, some of the things that Councillor Jackson was talking about, namely housing, also one of the most important issues for Boston residents. So why do you think there was sort of that gap there between Jackson's messaging and what the electorate heard?
Well, I think that, I mean, I think the problem is that I think that the mayor is seen as someone who's trying to tackle some of those things. Mm-hmm. I don't think people think he's AWOL on it. I think there's also a recognition that some of the problems that are raised on inequality in general and housing affordability are big, broad issues, and in some ways they're beyond the ability of a mayor to have as much influence as people might like. So I think he gets a bit of a pass on some of those.
Right. Well, I mean, so that's a good point, because, you know, we didn't just get here overnight in terms of all these problems, and no one really expects things to be fixed overnight. So let me just turn the question around to both of you. What are the opportunities then that Marty Walsh has now that he's been reelected? He has 65% of the vote. Does he have, what kind of mandate does he have to help us actually move forward significantly with these challenges?
I mean, I think he has a big mandate, as incumbent Boston mayors do. I mean, they always say that they amass a tremendous amount of political capital, and the challenge has always been, or I think in some ways the disappointment sometimes has been, that they squander it and they're too worried about, you know, about alienating constituencies. I mean, certainly I think if we say that, you know, the broad question of economic inequality is maybe beyond the power of a mayor to affect, control of the schools is now fully in the mayor's hands, you know, in Boston particularly, where we have mayoral control of the schools. And I think there are huge challenges there. And I think the mayor's been really tentative so far about taking those on, whether it's, you know, changes and reforms in how the schools operate, to the physical issue of school consolidation,
which is
kind of a third rail issue. Everyone knows it's coming. There was a lot of feeling that it was kind of punted or the can was kicked down the road till after the election. So that's one of many things that he's going to, you know, have to deal with in
Michael
the next
Curry?
Term.
Yeah, overall, I didn't think it was a good turnout, as we see across the country, and here was no exception, that the turnout in our communities—
Less than 30%.
Less than 30%. And even when you look at communities of color, I think Tito was hurt by the fact that communities of color didn't come out as strong as they could, and less than the neighborhoods like JP and West Roxbury and South Boston, some of the areas where Mayor Walsh did very well. I think part of it is, and again, we've beat this drum many times, it's a tale of two cities, right? That the reality is, if you're a police officer, a black police officer, you may have issues with the equity within the Boston Police Department, the opportunities, the promotion, the pipeline of officers. If you're a firefighter of color and you're not seeing a pipeline, there's a lot of things that were not done under this administration. And I think, and we've all said it and we've discussed it, Mayor Walsh is a great guy. We like him. But this is about setting a high bar for the city and making sure that there aren't neighborhoods that feel like they're not represented and that their issues aren't top of mind and that the solutions aren't readily available. And I think that that's the challenge for Mayor Walsh, is that this election woke him up, that people are not happy with some things under his administration, and he has an opportunity to do something about
it. So is that what you meant when during our special coverage on Tuesday night, you said that do I think voters of color in communities voters of color in communities really knew what was at stake and what measures to look at in evaluating this mayor? No, you said.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing about elections in general, right? And I think anyone who's ever watched and been in politics knows that the challenge is, how do you make the electorate understand what the issues are that are at stake? So if you're an African-American mother in Roxbury and you don't understand economic development and housing and education, you may not know that your grandkids and your kids are getting a bum opportunity in terms of their education compared to other school systems, other neighborhoods, other towns. So you may not know that. And it's the responsibility of organizations and individuals to say, hey, this is where we are and this is where we should be. And unfortunately, the NAACP report card, to credit to the Boston branch, came out pretty late, but it was timely in the sense that it gave voters some opportunity to look at the data in it. But we need to make sure we do that on a timely basis on these next 4 years, so that when he runs in 4 years, people are really holding him accountable to the data as to whether he did what he needed to do.
Michael Jonas, what's your thought on that?
I mean, I think one real problem with this, and it kind of gets into the question of how the race was covered. Michael's talking about, you know, whether people really understood what was at stake.
Yeah.
And we did hear a lot during the race, you know, particularly from Tito Jackson, complaints that the race wasn't getting enough coverage. I guess I have, you know, I'm trying not to be too defensive as part of the media. You know, I think some of his points were well taken, but I think there's a little bit of a chicken and egg dynamic at play when, you know, he was so underfunded and so sort of unable to kind of energize a voting base to sort of turn this into a more competitive race. That would have in turn certainly led to more coverage. You know, they argue, again, this chicken and egg thing, that more coverage would have energized people. And we always have that argument. I mean, I think, you know, not to be too much of a sort of Debbie Downer on it, but it's just been the nature of things that Boston mayors, when they're running for re-election, anything other than an open race for mayor, you know, mayors have huge advantages. And we saw Marty Walsh, as Tom Menino did, they do everything they can to sort of downplay the race, to sort of not energize people. They, you know, the mayor did not agree to, you know, a whole set of debates.
Yeah. Right.
And so I think it's, you know, they end up not being really the platform or the forum where we really have a really vigorous, good discussion of the issues, which is, of course, this is when we're supposed to have those. But that's just been the reality. I mean, it's sad to say.
I will just put it on us as the media that maybe next time around we ought to look for more creative ways to really energize the conversation. I'll just leave it at that for now.
And make sure that we can reach communities of color. I think part of what we're with mainstream media is that are they penetrating the neighborhoods in Roxbury, Dorchester, Mattapan? I would say you could take polls. I'm not sure how many people are waking up and reading the papers or tuning in. Maybe what we can do going into these next few years is really to go into those communities and broadcast live or
connect,
cover some stories that are more of interest to them. But we don't do it as much as we should.
Right. Agreed. I mean, because we say communities of color, but we're talking about Boston.
Right.
Right.
Exactly.
So that's the whole point. Well, let's talk about the city council here for a minute, if we can, because speaking of diversity, 6 of the 13 seats on the city council are now held by women of color, the other 7 by white men. I mean, this is a really big change for Boston City Council, a welcome one. I'd say, Michael Jonas, what difference do you think it's going to make?
Well, I mean, I think that I think it will make a big difference, but I think there's a big question mark that remains. The question mark is that the Boston City Council has historically not been a very potent force,
and your reality checks.
Not provided that great a check. With that said, I think we can sort of, you know, let's be hopeful and think about the idea that this council of a very different makeup, you know, is going to sort of bring some change to that. And I certainly think you know, I mean, not to single her out, but Lydia Edwards, who I covered a bit when she actually ran last year in a special state Senate election, is a really dynamic person. I mean, she was a community organizer. She was somebody who has real experience sort of pushing issues to the fore that, you know, that people might be uncomfortable with or that the powers that be would just as soon have ignored. So, I mean, that's certainly the kind of profile that you would hope would lead her to be part of a voice on the council to kind of push issues and challenge the administration in a way that the council maybe hasn't.
Yeah. So, Michael Curry, let me ask you about that, because I actually do appreciate that Michael Jonas brought up the sort of limited power of the city council. I mean, how much do you think, because the new voice, the diversity of voices is definitely going to be there. We're going to hear from them during city council meetings. We're going to hear from them in terms of the policies that they take up. But if you do run into the sort of limited power in terms of affecting change for the very people that they're representing, isn't that going to forever be a problem here?
Yeah, I mean, so I think it's limited power, but there is power. I think about the body camera conversation and the hearings that I attended around the body cameras. It was the city council that led that conversation.
Right, wasn't that Councilor Campbell?
Councilor Campbell pushed the city of Boston around that with the Boston Camera Action Team with Shogun Ito. And I think that that's an example of where they can be very impactful is the bully pulpit. But I also think that the critical part about these 6 women and what this creates in terms of a pipeline is that the city council is a stepping stone to other opportunities. Mm-hmm. Our next mayor, potentially our mayor of color beyond Mayor Walsh, could be a woman and a person of color out of that group. That's exciting. In the history of this city, we've only had white men. In the history of this city, we've only had the first woman of color was Ayanna. The first Asian American was Michelle Wu.
Yep.
That is ridiculous in a city of this size with that much diversity. That's talent we left on the table all these years. So I think I'm excited because, and particularly Kim Janey is a good friend of mine. She's going to be dynamic in that building. And there's a lot for us to be excited about.
But my turn for reality check, you might have to wait 20 more years given mayors in the city of Boston.
Right.
Let's turn now to Framingham, because actually, in a way, I'm most excited about what's happening in Framingham, because the city of Framingham elected its very first mayor ever there, Yvonne Spicer. She's a current town meeting member, vice president for advocacy and educational partnerships at the Museum of Science. Now, the reason why Framingham hadn't had a mayor before is because it wasn't a city, but they voted to turn themselves into a city. Very tight vote, just 104 votes. And now they have picked Yvonne Spicer as their mayor-elect. Michael Jonas, first of all, what do you think about her as mayor-elect, and what are the immediate challenges that she's got right in front of her?
I mean, I think that, you know, from everything that I know of her, I mean, she's, you know, super impressive. And I think, you know, first and foremost, you know, with all of the sort of taking note of kind of the firsts and barriers that were being broken in her race or Lydia Edwards, I mean, these people are, I think, were really elected because they were, you know, they struck the voters as highly competent. They addressed the issues. So, I think that, you know, it's a credit, you could say, or maybe it's long overdue, that voters, you know, were voting for the candidate they thought was best, you know, irrespective of race or gender.
Yeah.
But I think that's first and foremost. She seems totally poised to lead the city. I mean, there are differences, you know, when you move to sort of a mayoral system. And so she's going to be now the top manager, which is different than, you know, these communities have for decades or centuries had relied on a professional manager.
I mean, they're building a city government basically from scratch.
Right, yeah. Right, right. And it's sort of like, as they say, fixing the plane as it's in flight. I mean, they've still got to be functioning and moving ahead,
yeah.
But sort of making that transition.
Michael Curry?
And I've had an opportunity over the years that I was president of NAACP, and even some years prior to that, to work with prior mayors. I worked quite a bit with Mayor Menino, some with Walsh, a lot with Bill Carpenter in Brockton. From what I know of her and the folks that I know of her, she's going to be powerful for the city. And I think that she has the skill sets and, as Michael said, the talent, the expertise, the professional background, that she'll hit the ground running and she'll do very well.
All right. Good. Well, so that's kind of a very quick roundup of what happened on election night here in Massachusetts. I want to turn now to another major story this week. This has to do with Berklee College of Music, because the Boston Globe reported this week that several students have reported being assaulted, groped, or pressured into having sex with teachers there. Here's Boston Globe reporter Kay Lazar, who reported on the story, describing one of the allegations.
A Berklee student alleged that one of her professors, who was her mentor, had offered to walk her home from a gathering, a party, because obviously she was had drunk too much. And then she doesn't remember a whole lot more, but woke up the next morning and she was naked and he was laying next to her and groping her.
Well, and the Globe's report also said that Berklee allowed three male professors to quietly leave since 2008 after student complaints against them. And, of course, this all comes in the midst of all of these revelations from Point to a Corner, and revelations are coming out about sexual harassment and assault. So, Michael Curry, let me just start with you. Like, what do you take about what do you make of what's been reported about what's happening at Berklee?
Yeah, I was appointed by Governor Patrick to serve on RCC's board during some of that tension that was there and some of the allegations that happened at RCC, and it's come a long way. There are laws in place and some regulatory framework that is supposed to address these things on college campuses. So I'm curious to see how that plays out and what Berklee will do to respond to that. The transparency, the accountability piece is important. You can't just ship people off to be victimizers in other places. You gotta notify folks that the person is accused of something, and you gotta provide some notice to the students. And I think that we're dropping the ball on that, not just at Berklee, across the country, and that there's that protection of the reputation, that competing interest to not damage the reputation of the school, the company, the organization, the industry. We gotta get past that.
Michael Jonas.
Well, I mean, you know, with a lot of these cases nationally, they're kind of, I don't know if the term is one-offs. I mean, they involve an individual and a set of victims. In this case, you know, as Michael is saying, we're talking about an institution. And yeah. I couldn't help being here in Boston, but here sort of in this, an echo of the Catholic church scandal involving priests. Because, again, the reflex was to protect Berklee, to protect the institution. So they were getting these students to, you know, agree to stay quiet, paying settlements, and essentially – you know, while the church moved priests to other churches, they were letting faculty members move. I think one moved just from Berkeley to New England Conservatory.
Yeah.
So
the
parallels
Lundy,
were
right.
just sort of eerie and creepy.
So Michael was talking about what some potential responses should be or could be from institutions. Like you said, calling for more transparency,
right.
And letting people know. But so talk to me in a little bit more detail. What exactly would that look like, say, in Berkeley's case?
Yeah, well, I mean, one is there's reporting requirements. So I'd be curious if they were compliant with the reporting requirements that exist. That's one. Two, I think, is really about the culture of the institution. And that's a softer one. But it's one around notifying women to be careful and what to look out for. And maybe even some men as well. And I'm not sure if the school, and again, I think it's not just that school, it's across the country. And most of us who've had college experiences know, or have been in companies, know that people drink and people do things, and then people end up in these situations. And we just have to be more diligent about preventing these things. And that's an onus we all have, not any one particular person.
Well, we have a little bit more tape here from Boston Globe reporter Kay Lazar on the response that she's got from her story so far. And here's what she said.
Every hour I'm hearing from parents, I'm hearing from students, I'm hearing from faculty and former faculty. The inbox is overflowing.
And Kay also has told us that they only published the stories they had documentation for, and now they've got a lot more. So, Michael Jonas, I just wanted to have you pick up on what
sure.
Michael Curry was saying on what should the proper institutional response be?
Well, I mean, I think the things that Mike points out on the institutional side are all necessary and appropriate. But I think there's also, there's got to be some recognition, I would hope, that what's happening with this media coverage is also, an important part. It's not sort of a structural sort of institutional response, but, you know, the whole idea about sunlight and what that can do to things, the fact that we are hopefully pulling back the curtain and we are sort of telling people to come forward with things, that, you know, in itself ought to, I think, be part of what the dynamic is going forward, and that you know, people are going to feel more empowered and more able to come forward.
Well, I hope so, because, you know, I'm also thinking of all the reporting about, you know, a culture on Beacon Hill, for example, as well. And to my mind, we can put in sort of structural reporting requirements for transparency, et cetera. But really, you got to affect the culture change,
that's
right?
What everybody
keeps
saying.
And it seems like that is the toughest nut to crack, right? And the transparency and the willingness to come forward is only the first step to that.
Right. And leadership matters, right? You saw the Speaker of the House, I think the Senate President, both came out with statements and very definitive decisions around what to do going forward. I think we're in that place where we now have to hold leaders accountable to do those things. And the other conversation is around innocent until proven guilty, right?
Mm-hmm.
We have to wait
Absolutely.
Till this stuff plays out. Now, that's a criminal side, but it's also a public opinion side, too, is to let these things play out. We do know that it is prevalent. We do know that there are many legitimate cases. Let's make sure that we let this play out, but let's hold people accountable in a way that makes sense.
I think that's a really important point to call, because, you know, there are some cases where maybe there's somewhat more of a gray area. But I'm thinking back to one of those cases at Berkeley where the professor even sent text messages
Absolutely.
To the student afterwards admitting as to what had happened. And this is the same person who went on to teach at two other local music schools. So
it's a no-brainer.
Yeah.
He shouldn't be working.
All right. Well, we have I'm going to try and make a turn here to some hopefully more positive news, because we have just enough time for our hubbubs. And those are the stories that maybe didn't make it to the top of the newscast this week, but worth a mention nonetheless. So, Michael Jonas, your hubbub?
Well, I will be positive. And,
good.
And I'll start with saying we hear a lot about naysayers. So my hubbub has to do with yaysayers. So this week, organizers announced that Boston next year is going to be host to a national conference of the YIMBY movement, which stands for Yes in My Backyard. They're kind of the counterpoint to NIMBYs, or Not in My Backyard. And this is a national network of groups that works to promote policies to see more housing built in cities at greater density. And it just seems like that'll be a great conversation. We just had municipal elections in Boston and Cambridge, where the issue of the dearth of affordable housing was front and center. So we're going to sort of have that even the national conversation come to Boston in the fall.
Oh, absolutely. So YIMBYs. Maybe we're going to see T-shirts that say yes in my backyard pretty soon as well. Michael Curry?
I think, you know, my hubbub would be an article I saw recently about a mutiny aboard one of the cruise liners, Costa Cruises. And essentially what we're seeing play out in transportation across the board, and particularly with American Airlines and some of the other airlines, people are not happy. And in this case, in the cruise, they changed, I think, three or four of the locations they were planning to go to and canceled the stops. And the passengers mutinied. they protested, banged on tables, and decided that they were upset with the changes. And they were not happy with the 150 euros that the cruise line offered to make them whole. So to me, that's a sign of many more things that come when we have unhappy passengers.
Well, I guess it always helps to keep your passengers as happy as possible, especially when you're on a ship in the middle of the ocean. So my hubbub has to do with the Boston Globe's website and actually the Boston Globe's tech infrastructure. And really, guys, my hat's off to you because they got attacked. They had a distributed denial of service attack over Wednesday and Thursday, essentially hacked. Hackers took the Boston Globe's website down for several hours yesterday. And you can see, like, this is my hubbub because we rely on the Globe and the Herald and stuff to keep us updated on certain things throughout the day. And if you think that this means that, like, the Globe's is up there with Equifax and stuff, no. I can say that for sure. Maybe sort of the saddest thing about the attack on the Globe is that this kind of internet attack, according to Arbor Networks of Burlington, has already happened this year 7.1 million times, or 23,000 times a day. Some site is hit by a DDoS attack because all it takes is a couple of bucks and someone with some malware on the Internet of Things, and they can take your website down. So Globe, you did a good job getting your site back up, and I appreciate it, but you're one of 7.1 million such attacks this year. That's my hubbub for today. Michael Curry, former president of the Boston branch of the NAACP, thank you so much for joining us. And Michael Jonas, executive editor of Commonwealth Magazine, thank you as well.
Thank you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In 2010, Kalief Browder was locked up at Rikers Island in New York. He was only 16 years old. He was never convicted of a crime. He hadn't yet had a trial. But he spent 3 years at Rikers, suffering abuse at the hands of inmates, guards. He also spent 2 years in solitary confinement. The reason he was there? His family was too poor to afford bail.
Well, my family tried to get me a public tried to get me a lawyer, but my family was doing, they was going through some hard times at the time, so they couldn't post bail or either get me a lawyer.
Well, Browder was eventually released, but he took his own life in 2015. He was just 22 years old. Georgetown Law professor Peter Edelman says Kalief Browder's life and death is just one of the many stories that show how the criminal justice system is radically tilted against poor Americans. He writes about this in his new book called Not a Crime to Be Poor, The Criminalization of Poverty in America. And Professor Edelman joins me now in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much. I'm so glad to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you. Now, I think many of our listeners might know about your long and storied career being an advocate for poor Americans, including your work with Robert Kennedy, for example. But what is it that triggered your attention and focus specifically on how smaller aspects of the criminal justice system lead to such, you know, terrible outcomes like Kalief Browder had?
One word for me, Ferguson. Mm-hmm. Now, when you talk about Kalief Browder, this is something that people knew about. People knew about how terrible Rikers is.
Yeah.
So the entry point for me in writing this book was not that. You inevitably get to Khalif Browder and the bail and how it is that the mental health places are the jails, not what we thought we were doing decades ago. But for me, it was finding out that not just Michael Brown, but the fact that they were in that small city were arresting their own people over and over again and squeezing them to get the money to run their city, and then to discover that that's a national fact.
Yeah. So there was the Justice Department's at least one of those studies coming out of post-Ferguson.
Fabulous report. Yeah. Yes, that was part of my learning.
So let's talk about in a little bit more detail then. I mean, when you say that in America, it has essentially become a crime to be poor, or it feels like that. I mean, what are some of the specific reasons for or ways in which we're seeing that?
Well, two categories here in the book. One is the fines and fees and how that has turned into this way of getting income to run the state or the city or the court system. And what happens, it really entraps people by the millions, and it's major, actually, in terms of the majority of it, is taking away people's driver's licenses that we have all over the country, 4 million people in California alone. But the other piece is it turns out that it's metastasized, and we're talking about kids who get sent to jail, to court, for something in the old days before would have been something at the principal's office.
And right.
So other things besides the fines and fees.
Well, but on the fines and fees, for example, I just want to focus on that for a moment.
Yes.
Because, I mean, as you write about, and others have as well, we're seeing all sorts of small fines and fees now for failure to showing up for a certain court date or failure to do X or Y, which can pile up on individual poor Americans. But the reason why cities and towns have levied so much, what is the reason for that? I mean, obviously, the money is being used for something.
Yes.
Why?
Well, the reason why is the anti-tax rebellion. People all over the country, those units of government all over the country, found that they were falling short because they didn't have the tax revenue. And in a rather cruel decision, they decided really all over the country to get the money out of their own citizens. And so that's why we have it. And it has been done in a way that is particularly hard on low-income people, and they're everywhere. They're disparately African-American and in other parts of the country, Latino.
I mean, is it going too far to say that we, in certain places, we have reached a system where poor Americans are being squeezed in order to subsidize a criminal justice system that they themselves are being cycled through?
Yes, and it's happening here in Massachusetts and has been for some time, having to have fees to be on probation, having to have fees to have a public defender, things you wouldn't think were going on here. There's good work going on right now among the leaders of both of the courts and in the legislature, and mm-hmm. so the Commonwealth is moving in the right direction.
Well, since you brought up Massachusetts, I've got some numbers here that might help us sort of understand what's happening here in this state. For example, about bail reform,
mm-hmm.
We had an SJC case that said that bail shouldn't be set beyond a person's ability to pay for it.
Yes.
And to put that in some context here, I was seeing some numbers from a study that said that more than 5,000 people every day in Massachusetts face pretrial incarceration. So it's not an insignificant number. And you see some like major disparities. There was a 2014 study that said in Middlesex County, for example, on October 31st, 2014, 22% of people in jail in Middlesex County on that day were there because they couldn't post $1,000
yes,
in bail.
Yes, and nationally, you have 700,000 people who were in jail on any given day, and 3/5 of those people are not yet, they have not been tried. And that's about bail that they can't that they can't pay. And the reason for that is the system doesn't have the capacity to have the trials. And so what they do is they use bail to squeeze people to come and plead guilty. Which in turn, for something they didn't do, in turn gets them into owing a lot of money. So it's a tool for that. And then once they're hooked, when they can't pay, it just goes on and on because added debts get piling up.
Well, again, just for context here, because some of the numbers are quite shocking. Mass Inc. did a study, and they found out in 2015 in Barnstable County, the median bail amount for a white person was $5,000. The median bail amount for a black person in Barnstable County was $20,000. So talk about the disparity.
Yes, well, absolutely. There's all the way through all of these things, there's a racial disparity, and that's part of the story. It's a story of race and poverty, poverty and race, a very dangerous intersection.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so you mentioned some reform efforts here in Massachusetts. There, you know, in the criminal justice reform bills, since we're talking about bail, I just might mention that advocates are really trying to move bail from a cash-based system, like we've been talking about, to one that's more evidence-based in terms of dangerousness.
That's right. And we have two things that are going on around the country. One is there are lawsuits that are beginning to be successful. The biggest one in Houston, Harris County in Texas, where the federal judge has declared that the system down there is unconstitutional because of the rich-poor difference. So that's coming along around the country. There are a number of these cases. But the second is that states, Kentucky, well, D.C. has been doing it basically right for 40 years. So it was always out there. And Connecticut, Kentucky had done it. But now we have this system that the Arnold Foundation has supported, which creates a way very carefully researched. This is the right way to do it, is to have statewide statutory change so that we really don't, it's much harder to fall back into the bad ways of doing it.
So let's presume for a moment that some of these reforms work. Where does that leave the same towns and their court systems that are so reliant on the income that's produced from charging fees for and posting high bails from all these poor people?
It's a problem. The answer is they're going to have to figure it out because this is not something that's acceptable.
Right.
But they got into it in the first place. People who, at least in some places, are sort of well-meaning and they fell into it. And then it's an addiction. So people have known for years here in Massachusetts that this was a problem. And people like Chief Justice Ralph Gantz would go to the legislature to ask them to change over a period of time and couldn't get anywhere because they kept on saying we need the money. This is really bad.
And I suppose finding other means of supporting the court system is also something that would help solve the problem, right? That should states be returning money to these criminal local criminal justice systems?
Well, they just need to figure out, and it can be done, to do it the way it was traditionally, which is it's public responsibility to run our court system.
Yeah.
Well, now it isn't just what we've said so far, but there's for-profit stuff all over the country, which is another terrible thing and also really it ruins the system.
Yeah. You know, I'm thinking about how deep and pervasive this problem is, because there's all sorts of ways in which justice is denied. I mean, I've had several conversations with former SJC Chief Justice Margaret Marshall, and, you know, she talked for years about how justice delayed is justice denied.
Yes.
And the backlog of cases all across the state.
Yes.
Is tremendous. But, you know, we're just scratching the surface here, Professor Edelman, of what you have in your book, and I really encourage people to read it to get a deeper understanding of things. But in the last couple of minutes that we have, since you are such a resource and your advocacy and scholarship on these issues is so deep, I'm just wondering, you know, in the many decades that you have been trying to fight poverty and trying to understand poverty in America, has the challenge become, do you think it's easier to solve or more insidious now than it was, say, in the 60s when you were working with Robert Kennedy?
Well, you know, one thing that is kind of people don't understand, that over the course of the last almost 50 years, the problem in terms of poverty is made worse by what's happened to the structure of our economy and all the terrible jobs that we have now compared to the good jobs in the manufacturing sector. The fact is that with the public policy that we have, if we didn't have those things, Social Security, earned income tax credit, food stamps, and so on, we would have twice as many people poor in poverty as we have right now. Something like close to 90 million people as opposed to the 43 million that we have. So, in fact, our public policy, people say, some people, certainly I don't like Paul Ryan and such like that, saying that nothing works. It does work. The context makes it hard, the economic concept. And it's also true, however, that race is still a factor in our politics. The changes in distribution, the inequality, these are problems. So we have serious challenges.
Got a ways to go, for sure. Well, Peter Edelman is a law professor at Georgetown University. His new book, It Is Not a Crime to Be Poor. It's a really terrific read. I encourage you all to do that. You can see him speaking at Porter Square Books tonight. We have more information about that at radioboston.org. Professor Edelman, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.